Ladies and gentlemen, the President of these United States speaking at the White House today.
The stock market is way up again today, and we're setting a record literally all the time. And I'm telling you, we have a long way to go.
That first part didn't really hold up. Not his fault, because markets, right? But that last bit, yeah, let's talk about that, shall we? From American Public Media, this is Market Flags. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Tuesday, the 16th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a caveat wrapped in a stipulation inside a truism, also with apologies to Winston Churchill, but that's a whole different deal. It goes like this. First of all, if you decide at your morning editorial meeting to do a stock market story because the Dow is up 282 points, the Dow will, repeat, will close down that day. Number two, the stock market is not the economy, no matter how many times a certain person likes to intimate that it is. And finally, stocks do go down as well. With all of that out of the way and so stipulated, it is worth a couple of minutes here nonetheless to try to get a sense of the, shall we say, enthusiastic Wall Street dynamic that we have right now. Mike Regan is a senior markets editor at Bloomberg. Mike, thanks for coming on.
Oh, thanks, Kai.
Let's do the cause and effect thing here first. What is going on with stocks?
Well, I think people are just very, very enthusiastic about just the general shape of the economy, not only in the U.S., but globally. It's sort of firing on all cylinders right now. And then you layer on top of that these massive tax cuts that just were passed last year, particularly the corporate tax rate. And we're looking at earnings growth for companies in the S&P 500 to grow about 15% this year, which is a super strong year for profits. So it's kind of, the perfect storm for a higher stock market at the moment.
Is it possible that things are getting a little too expensive? Are we perhaps a little irrationally exuberant, if I could coin a phrase?
I think that is absolutely a possibility. And it's tricky because traders sort of recognize this when it's happening, that the market takes what are basically excellent fundamentals and just gets carried away with it.
Yeah.
The problem is you don't really know how long it's going to be last. And in past bull markets, that euphoric stage, sort of the last push higher of the bull market, is very often the most rewarding. So it's sort of a risk-reward thing. It gets more risky, but the potential rewards are much greater, too.
As the market gets higher, talk to me about the disconnect with the actual underlying economy, right? Because people look at the Dow 26,000, people including the president, and they go, oh, everything's great. But in reality, there's some issues.
Right. And I think the biggest issue that people will worry about going forward is the path of interest rates. It's very unusual to get this type of economic stimulus in the form of tax cuts at this point in the economic cycle, when everything's going pretty well. So there's a concern that things could overheat a little bit and that inflation will finally really pick up. And that tends to cause interest rates to go higher. So that's sort of the biggest risk people are looking at now, that this might be coming at the wrong time and cause the economy to overheat.
Which gets me to my underlying point, which is for the many, many, many millions of Americans out there who are not in the market, at least half, probably more, they look at this and they go, great, Dow's at 26, but I got to make my mortgage.
Right. Like you said, the valuations of the market are extremely high, in some cases close to the highest they've ever been. And that doesn't necessarily mean the market is going to crash automatically when they reach a certain valuation. But most studies show that returns in the coming year, in several few years, are usually weaker than they typically are when valuations are this high. And that often includes some nasty dips. I mean, the dot-com right. bubble being the most prime example, I think, in most people's memory.
Right. And for those playing along at home, and of course, consult your own financial advisor, but it's a little tricky getting in when the rally is this long in the tooth and the upside is yet unexplored.
That's right. And, you know, from the Wall Street perspective, when they see a lot of sort of what is known as retail investors, basically individual yeah. investors, rushing into the market towards the end, it's often a sign that things are getting overheated. You know, when everyone is bullish about the stock market and everyone pours their money in, I mean, the flip side of that coin is that there's no one left really to come in.
Right.
On Wall Street, they start getting nervous when everyone's bullish and retail investors are really plowing a lot of money into the market.
Mike Regan, he's a senior markets editor at Bloomberg. Mike, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you, Kai.
Yeah, so down 26K, but then poof, strong start, weak finish. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Business is, rightly or wrongly, all about the bottom line, cold, hard profit and loss, which is, in a way, what makes this next item so interesting. This morning, Larry Fink, the CEO and co-founder of BlackRock, which is a truly ginormous asset management company. They do pensions and mutual funds, all kinds of things. Anyway, Larry Fink wrote a letter to a group of CEOs of big companies in this economy, telling them basically that they've got to do better by society. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes a look at BlackRock and its argument for doing well by doing good.
BlackRock manages a whole lot of money, about $6 trillion.
It is the monster in the asset management world.
Eric Gordon is a professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. He says controlling that much money and how it's invested, it gives BlackRock a lot of power.
One man might have the power to coerce every large public company to do what he thinks is right. The president can't do that. The Pope can't do it. Not even John Stewart can do it.
Today, Larry Fink, CEO of BlackRock, used that power to tell companies, quote, to prosper over time, every company must not only deliver financial performance, but also show how it makes a positive contribution to society. That's no longer the fringy idea it might have once been, says Jeff Graham. He manages a hedge fund and wrote a book about the rise of shareholder activism called Dear Chairman.
If you're BlackRock or Vanguard, then you are ultimately going to be holding these investments in big corporations forever. And so issues like sustainability become financial issues as a long-term shareholder. And I don't think a lot of these investors thought like that as explicitly 10 years ago.
Judith Samuelson, who, by the way, no relation to me, is the executive director of the Business and Society Program at the Aspen Institute. She says this means asking questions like,
what's the long-term consequences of the decisions we're making now? You know, this isn't for the faint of heart, and it doesn't mean that every year your stock price can go up.
Also, Samuelson says trying to monitor what all these companies are up to is going to be a huge task. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The corporate story of this Tuesday is courtesy of General Electric, the original American industrial conglomerate. GE's newish CEO, John Flannery, had some interesting things to say on the company's earnings call this morning. First of all, that he is, quote, deeply disappointed in some big liabilities that have been found in the company's insurance operations, a business that GE technically offloaded years ago. He even suggested, Flannery did, that the company is considering breaking itself up, that he wanted to, quote, move with purpose to reshape GE. Thing is, GE's been running with that refocus narrative pretty much since Flannery took over about 6 months ago. So the question is, for a company that is invested in so many different things, how easy is it to nail down what the core business might actually be? Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
GE's been making stuff since the 1890s. Think Thomas Edison, but not just light bulbs. The company got into everything.
Not quite, you name it, they sell it, but pretty close.
Lawrence White teaches economics at NYU. He says there were some benefits. GE got really good at a few new things. Its financial services company, GE Capital, became one of the most important in the world. Now,
they've had to pull back from that.
Because investors, unhappy with returns, have become impatient. So newish CEO John Flannery says the company will increase profits by focusing on three core operations: power, aviation, and healthcare technology. But even as that focus takes shape, GE's incredibly diversified past can get distracting. Like today, when GE announced the final numbers on liability from an insurance business it sold years ago. GE, it turns out, is still liable for billions of dollars in policies for nursing home care and assisted living.
Kind of a tsunami of events hit them all at once.
Tom Lomberg runs a life insurance consulting firm. He says it's not just GE. The whole business of insurance for long-term care is reeling.
Claims costs are higher. People go into assisted care facilities earlier and stay longer. They've earned far less than they thought they would on the premium, and the claims have come in faster and higher.
GE could sell the liability rather than pay the debt itself to try to limit damage to the parent company. But Nicholas Heyman, an analyst at William Blair who covers GE, says the insurance liability continues to pose a question for GE's long-term strategy.
Why do you have an asset like this that's holding back the optimization process from a cost standpoint, from a culture standpoint? The validity of that diversified approach has clearly now come into question.
The people questioning the loudest? GE shareholders. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The big complaint about the housing market in this country right now comes in two interconnected flavors. One, there aren't enough units, single-family homes, or apartments on the market, which means, number two, that rents and mortgages are too darn high. It's happening in a lot of American cities and, as you'll hear in a bit, in some big cities overseas as well. But Denver, Colorado is where this next item takes us. City officials have a new housing subsidy program they're rolling out, putting otherwise unoccupied high-end apartments within the reach of some middle-income professionals, nurses and teachers, for instance. Laura Casisto wrote about it for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Give me the quick once-over on the Denver apartment and housing market, would you?
Sure. So Denver, like a lot of cities around the country, has a bit of a paradoxical situation. They have a glut of high-end luxury apartments, but a continuing affordability crisis. And so they came up with what seems on its face like an ingenious solution, which was simply to subsidize lower and middle income people and put them in some of these extra empty luxury units.
Yeah. Who is going to pay for this? Obviously, this is taxpayer money, right?
Yeah, most of the money is coming from the city. They're getting a little bit from local employers.
And the subsidy level will be what percentage of the price, do you know?
Yeah, so typically the rule of thumb is you shouldn't spend more than 30% of your income on housing. So they'll spend 30% of their income plus an extra 5%, which will go into a savings account, which is supposed to help them save for a down payment. So you're looking at a subsidy level from the city in the sort of $500, $900 range.
Which, assuming this all works out, is really a great way to solve this dilemma of excess luxury apartments. Unless, to play devil's advocate here, you're paying full freight. You're a person who's come in off the economy and you're in one of these buildings. And now all of a sudden, the government's helping other people out. And you're like, what?
Yeah. And I think one issue that economists have with it is essentially you're propping up the luxury market. You're really giving, in many ways, a subsidy to landlords who built too many apartments. And now the city is helping to pay for them to fill it. That's certainly the devil's advocate argument.
Yeah. The other thing they're doing, though, is they're also taking excess supply off the market. Right. And when you do that, in theory, prices and the value should go down.
Right, exactly. And so in a lot of cities, including Denver, the market is working the way that it should. Developers have built too many apartments, and so we're starting to see rents decline. But what the city's argument is, it's just happening too slowly for people now. It could take 2 or 3 years for us to see meaningful price declines to the point where people can afford these units. And we just don't want to wait that long. We need units for people now so they don't leave the city because they can't afford it.
Yeah. You point out in the piece that cynics among the folks out there might say, listen, we're going to market this as a socially conscious apartment building and hopefully get more, you know, full rate paying people in here.
Yeah. I asked a developer, you know, are you concerned about people who are paying the full price, living alongside people who are paying, you know, in a lot of cases, half price? And he said, well, maybe this will work like a LEED certified building, the way that we advertise that we're environmentally friendly. We'll advertise that we're socially conscious.
And there'd be a little sort of certification right at the front door, right? You'd be socially conscious platinum, I guess.
Something like that.
Yeah. Is this, though, a sustainable way to do housing policy?
I think the problem is we don't have a sustainable way to do housing policy. We build affordable units, but they cost, in Denver, $250,000 to build. In places like New York and San Francisco, even more than that, sometimes close to $1 million per unit. That's not very efficient. We have existing voucher programs from the federal government, but they're not getting any bigger, and if anything, they're shrinking. And so I think cities are just searching around and groping in the dark for answers and coming up with a lot of imperfect solutions.
Laura Cassisto writes at the Wall Street Journal most recently about housing policy in Denver, low-income vouchers. Laura, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Coming up.
Where's Catan? How do Catan look like? Could be a frame for a full and rich story.
Anybody up for a somewhat obscure German board game? Anybody? First, let's do the numbers. Well, the Dow Industrials crossed 26,000 for the first time today and then uncrossed it. At the close, the blue chip's down 10 points, less than a tenth percent, 25,792. The NASDAQ off a half percent, about 37 points. 72.23, the S&P 500 down 0.3%, about 9 points, 27.76. As we told you, General Electric taking a big write-down because of losses in its insurance business. Shares down almost 3% today. Investors liked BlackRock's plan to ask for social accountability in exchange for its investment. BlackRock shares climbed 1.3% today. Legg Mason gave back 1.1%. Invesco off about 1.7%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.54%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There is a pretty textbook list of things that American politicians do or say in response to complaints that cities are getting too crowded or expensive. They talk about making housing more affordable. You heard that with me talking to Laura Cassisto. Maybe more money for public transportation. You know the drill. The Chinese government hasn't ruled any of that out, but it has also come up with a somewhat more radical approach for the city of Shanghai. They want to put an official limit on the size of the population there. Beijing, the central government, has decided that by the year 2035, Shanghai's population ought to be around 25 million people, which is a lot, but it's going to be tricky because that is not many more people than Shanghai has today. Our China correspondent Jennifer Pak is in Shanghai.
When you get on or off a bus in Shanghai, make sure to look both ways. There could be electric bikes and bicycles weaving through the tiny space between the bus and the sidewalk. Everyone is in a rush to beat the traffic jam. It's just as crowded below ground, says Chen Guoqiang, who's been working in Shanghai for 6 years.
Whether you take the metro or bus, people are squished together.
He also says the air is polluted and the rent is expensive. China's leaders call these problems big city diseases, and they place some of the blame on poor migrants like Chen Guoqiang flooding the city. Shanghai's population is now nearly three times bigger than New York City's, so officials don't want the numbers to go any higher. How will they stop that? Yan Yuejing is with the real estate research institute called eHouse.
The land supply in this latest plan is very small. If land is controlled, everything else will be controlled. You can't build as many new houses, and there will not be more space for industries.
Other measures may involve cracking down harder on people living in buildings without city permits or sharing small apartments with several families. This will force low-paid migrants out, says demographics expert Huang Wenzheng. And if these policies don't work?
Beijing has demolished some schools for the children of migrant workers. Shanghai may take similar action. Another measure is to clear out low-end industries.
Perhaps the main control tool the government has is a system called Hukou. It prevents people from rural areas from accessing certain social benefits like pension and education in the cities. Take Chen Guoqiang's son, Hao Hao, for example. He is a happy 7-year-old about to start school. But since his parents are not from the city, he doesn't have permission to complete his studies in Shanghai. Hao Hao and his mother are planning to return to their hometown in central Hubei province. Migrants are sometimes treated like undocumented workers in the U.S. despite these restrictions, there are still more people coming to Shanghai than leaving it because they can earn at least twice what they would in their hometowns. That's why previous efforts to limit the number of people in China's megacities have all failed. Again, Huang Wenzheng.
I do not think there's any rational economic reason to limit the size of the population.
He says, if anything, the city needs more people. Shanghai's population is aging faster than others in China, he says, so it needs migrants to replenish the workforce.
China's biggest resource is its population of almost 1.4 billion people. This advantage has led to recent economic and technological developments that, in some cases, have surpassed the U.S.
He says low-skilled migrants are part of that equation. They keep the city clean, feed its hungry workers, and take care of its kids. China should allow freedom of movement, Huang says. Otherwise, China's next Jack Ma or Steve Jobs might end up stuck in his home village without the resources to develop his talent. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Today in celebrities, they're just like us, board games. The actress Mila Kunis, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, also Andrew Luck, the quarterback of the Indianapolis Colts. They are all said to be fans of the German board game Catan. It deals mostly with trade and economics, not what one might imagine would make for a good Hollywood blockbuster, but there are bets being made that Catan is the next big entertainment franchise, as Caitlin Regg reports.
Here's the basic premise of Catan. Players represent tribes who have landed on the island of Catan. They jockey for the best position to collect resources, grow settlements, and beat their opponents.
It's a really cleverly designed game that you never really know, really until the very end, who's going to win.
Adam Williams stands with about 24 other Catan fans at a gaming convention in Darmstadt, Germany. They're getting ready to compete for a spot at the National Catan Championships. As an announcer wishes them luck, players sit down to start their games. You can find meetups like this around the world. Catan has a devoted following. More than 27 million Catan sets in 39 languages have been sold since the game was released about two decades ago. Now the board game may be headed to the big screen. Sony Pictures is in negotiations to acquire the rights to adapt Catan. Some fans, like Adam Williams, wonder whether the game can survive the Hollywood treatment.
If they just take the name of the game, but then they create something which has nothing really to do with how the game works, that would be a shame.
That also concerns Catan's creator, Klaus Teuber, who lives not far from Darmstadt in a small town near a forest. He designed the game in the 80s as a passion project while working full-time as a dental technician, and he has painstakingly shepherded all Catan spin-offs. Teuber wants a movie or TV series to resonate with fans and answer their questions.
I think they want to know where come the Catanians from, where's Catan, how do Catan look like. I think this is could be a frame for a full and rich story.
Teuber says he's open to new brand tie-ins and extensions for Catan. There's a Star Trek Catan and a Silicon Valley-themed Catan. But all new iterations of the game must honor the core elements of the Catan story and the expectations of the fans who love it. Klaus's son Benjamin is one of the Catan company's managing directors.
People must be like, oh, this makes so much sense. And it must feel good. And if you don't feel it, then this is like, oh, they want to make money. And they would be right if we did it.
Movies based on board games have a mixed track record. Audiences panned Clue in the 80s. Battleship tanked with the critics, but still grossed more than $300 million worldwide. Mitchell Block is an adjunct professor at the University of Southern California's School of Cinematic Arts. He says despite the lack of critical success for previous board game movies, he thinks adapting Catan is a smart move and a logical next step.
You know, when you have something that's as well known as this game and have such tremendous recognition, that's a huge start in any brand extension.
He says Catan already has the brand recognition to help with audience turnout, and he thinks there's a little downside for the Teubers. If the movie's great,
it will just help extend the name of the brand. And if the movie's dreadful, it won't hurt because the people playing the game are playing the game for totally different reasons.
Those are not bad odds for people who think a lot about the art of strategy and risk. I'm Caitlin Regg from Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, offered without judgment, but with a dash of, oh boy, that's a pity. Saudi Arabia, as you might have read, has decided to allow movies to be shown to the general public. There was a screening in Jeddah this weekend in a government-run cultural center, complete with popcorn and everything, which is great. Movies are fun. The film being shown, though, the first full-length feature in the kingdom in 35 years, The Emoji Movie. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 10 points today, less than a tenth percent, up 282 at one point beyond 26K. The NASDAQ down about a half percent, 37 points. S&P 500 dropped 3/10, about 9%, 9 points rather there. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote does video for us. Sarah Muti is our executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow. Bye. This is APM.